It is Wednesday, November 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President-elect Donald Trump nominates South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley to be U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. We look at the increasing attention paid to the alt-right movement here in the U.S. And turkeys are the guests of honor at an unusual Thanksgiving celebration. It's all ahead. President-elect Donald Trump has named South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley to be the United States' ambassador to the United Nations, the first woman he's named to his cabinet. The 44-year-old daughter of Indian immigrants is serving her second term as governor of the Mid-Atlantic state. I spoke to VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir about Haley's nomination and asked why Trump selected her.
Well, he put out a press release this morning saying she's one of the most universally respected governors in the country. You know, he likes superlatives, and that she worked in her family business, and she became governor of South Carolina when she was 39 years old. She has 5 years experience as governor, and she's done good things for the state, he says. She's also, importantly, the first woman he's put in his cabinet, and she's also a woman of color. She's an Indian American.
However, during the campaign, she clashed with Mr. Trump a few times, although eventually she did end up supporting him.
Right. She supported Marco Rubio of Florida and then Ted Cruz of Texas, but she met Mr. Trump last week in New York, and she seems to have obviously mended fences with him, and I think he's trying to give the impression that he's ready to reach out to all members of the Republican Party, too, because he needs to heal the wounds within his own party if he wants to be successful.
Even though Nikki Haley is the child of Indian immigrants to the United States, how much foreign policy experience does she have?
Well, I think that's the big question. That's hanging, the question mark that's hanging over her nomination. It'll be interesting to see if the Senate confirms her. I mean, she really has no foreign policy experience to speak of. As a governor, she made some trade missions to Europe. She received some foreign delegations in her state. She brought some foreign investment also to South Carolina. But that doesn't necessarily mean she's well-versed on issues like the conflict in Syria, the conflict in Yemen, ISIS, you know, things that are of pressing concern here at the United Nations. As far as I can tell, she's never made an official visit to Africa. And Africa issues pertaining to Africa are about 80% of the Security Council agenda. So she's going to have a steep learning curve. I've spoken to some analysts this morning. They say don't underestimate her, that she has taken on many challenges and risen to them in the past, but that she will have a steep learning curve.
How important do you think that Trump nominated, you know, for a high-ranking post, that he nominate a woman for a cabinet position?
Well, I think some people here were also questioning the timing of the announcement of this position, because the UN ambassadorship is not one of the high-profile, really, cabinet posts. Often Republicans don't even have it as a cabinet post. It's the Democrats who do, but Trump said he's going to keep it as a cabinet post, I think in part, perhaps, because he needs to up his numbers of women and minorities in his cabinet. He hasn't named any yet, so she'll be the first one possibly to be in the cabinet if she's confirmed that is a woman. So I think the timing of this now, he wants to get it out there that he's nominated a woman. Also, I'm surprised it's coming now before we hear who the Secretary of State's going to be, because that's really the more important position on foreign policy in the cabinet. Some analysts I was talking to today say they suspect this Haley's nomination may be to soften the blow of who the Secretary of State's going to be, if it's going to be a Bolton or a Giuliani, another hawkish white man of a certain age.
That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. Well, joining me by phone is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, a lot of the things that Margaret just touched on are being discussed on social media regarding Nikki Haley and also Dr. Ben Carson. Now, Ben Carson is a neurosurgeon with no previous political experience, but he's been involved with the Trump campaign. He ran for president at one point. And Donald Trump tweeted out, actually, and said that he's considering Carson for the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. So Haley and Carson together are kind of getting lumped together, where you have people in one side saying they don't have experience for these positions. They don't, you know, Haley not having foreign policy experience. Carson even has come out and said that he doesn't feel comfortable serving because he doesn't have political experience. He said that a few weeks ago. But then on the other side, you say, you know, people say that these are the first two cabinet picks that are not white men. The first five appointments that Trump announced were white men. So he's bringing in diverse people and outsiders. Nikki Haley, serving in South Carolina as governor, has been outside Washington. Ben Carson, not having no political experience, has been outside Washington. So you do have this back and forth on social media about those picks. And even questions about the timing with the Thanksgiving holiday tomorrow, wondering if people are going to maybe talk about some of these picks or the selection of Nikki Haley around the dinner table. And with that, Thanksgiving tomorrow, the other trending story is, of course, Thanksgiving and the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, a huge tradition here in the U.S. But there's going to be an interesting way to watch it this year because of all the digital and technological advances that we have. For the first time, NBC, the network here in the U.S., and Verizon, the cell phone company, are going to partner and stream the parade on YouTube using 360-degree cameras and pop-up graphics with different facts about the parade. So you can actually go on YouTube, watch the parade, and not just watch it as you would on TV, but feel like you're there, being able to scroll around and watch in 360 degrees. So a new way to watch an American tradition, which I believe is celebrating its 90th year this year.
Yeah, and you can watch it that way without getting cold.
Yes, absolutely. That's the big thing. It's supposed to be a chilly day here in New York tomorrow, so I will be at home under blankets watching it on my laptop.
Okay, thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Turkey increases pressure on Syrian Kurds. South Sudanese flee one of the country's last peaceful towns. The Dalai Lama says he has no worries about the presidency of Donald Trump. And a far-right extremist is found guilty of killing a British lawmaker. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of astronomers led by scientists at Japan's Tohoku University has discovered an incredibly faint dwarf satellite galaxy orbiting the Milky Way. The galaxy, named Virgo 1, is located toward the direction of the Virgo constellation and is about 280,000 light years from the Sun. With an absolute magnitude of -0.8 in the optical wave band, the astronomers think it may well be the faintest satellite galaxy that has been found so far. Satellite galaxies are relatively smaller collections of stars that are gravitationally bound to larger galaxies, such as our own Milky Way. At this time, around 50 of the Milky Way's satellite galaxies have been identified by scientists. The astronomers say their discovery suggests that there may be many more of these dwarf satellite galaxies circling the Milky Way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we visit an Iraqi city terrorized by the Islamic State. In an editorial meeting Tuesday with the New York Times, Donald Trump repudiated the white supremacist alt-right movement, a fervent segment of the electorate that supports the president-elect. Trump sought to distance himself from the alt-right days after white nationalists shouted Nazi slogans at an event just blocks from the White House. National Policy Council President Richard Spencer spoke to followers at the gathering, some of whom responded with Nazi salutes. The president-elect has named Stephen Bannon as chief White House strategist and senior counselor. Bannon was formerly the executive chair of Breitbart News, a conservative website. I spoke with Nicole Hemmer, assistant professor at the University of Virginia and author of the new book, Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. I asked her how Bannon changed Breitbart following the 2012 death of its founder, Andrew Breitbart.
So when Andrew Breitbart started Breitbart News, it really was sort of the online, scrappier, younger brother of Fox News. It had a very clear conservative identity. It was involved in investigative reporting and in actual news production. When Bannon took over, he began to shift it away from
conservatism toward what the site now calls populist nationalism, that it's actually now encouraging conservatives to let go of some of their policy preferences on things like immigration, on foreign policy, and those sorts of things. And he also turned it into what he proudly proclaimed the platform of the alt-right, making it a space where folks who had more fringe right-wing beliefs, including white supremacy, anti-Semitism, anti-woman attitudes, strong anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim attitudes, that they would feel at home at Breitbart. And certainly that has become the case.
Now, who coined that term, alt-right?
So alt-right was actually coined by Richard Spencer in a magazine that he began publishing online in 2008 called Alternative Right. And that became sort of the first home of the alt-right online, that along with a magazine called Talkies Magazine. And these two places were sort of the home of the alt-right, and it was pretty underground, pretty invisible until the rise of Milo Yiannopoulos. Milo Yiannopoulos is sort of a provocateur who is sort of an in-person troll of a kind. He gets a great deal of joy and also political power out of essentially trying to upend PC culture by saying racist, anti-Semitic, anti-woman things. And he was hired in 2014 at Breitbart as their tech editor. So that's one of the more explicit connections between the alt-right and Breitbart.
Now, in recent months, I guess you could say Yiannopoulos and also Spencer, they've both been banned on Twitter.
That's right. It's actually quite interesting. Twitter is, as you know, a micro-publishing site and is pretty wide open in the people that they allow on there. I mean, trolling communities, white supremacy communities, all of these have been on Twitter since it was launched back in 2004. So it is a change in policy, I think, for Twitter to actively ban folks. Now, Yiannopoulos was banned because he was trying to corral people to attack a black actress. And that had this level of threat and this level of harassment that Twitter could say easily, clearly violated its terms of service. The mass sort of purge of alt-right personalities on Twitter, that is something new. And I don't think that the company has really fully explained why they made the decision to boot Richard Spencer and some other alt-right leaders, which it did a few weeks ago.
Yeah, and I believe that Spencer, in addition, he's been banned from the UK as well as a number of other European countries because of some of his theories.
That's right. I mean, that's something that I think Americans would find surprising, that the UK in particular has banned a number of right-wing personalities. People like Michael Savage, the radio host, isn't allowed in the UK either, because they have much stricter hate crime laws and hate speech laws in the UK and in many European countries. And so that has led to bans on these alt-right leaders. And that's important because folks like Spencer, people like Bannon, really do model themselves in a way after the European far right. Those groups that have gained power in Europe over the past 5 to 10 years are seen as examples for how to build an anti-immigrant, anti-Islam right here in the United States.
Well, this past weekend, there was a meeting of the National Policy Institute, and there's a fairly widely circulated video of Spencer speaking there where he says, "Hail Trump." He also quotes, uses a German phrase, lying press, Lügenpresse, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then a number of people in the audience get up and literally give the Nazi salute. Considering this is happening in the Ronald Reagan building, which is just a few blocks from the White House, it's quite disturbing.
It is. Now, we should stress that this is a fairly small group. I mean, the people at that conference numbered only about 200, but 200 people who are speaking German and throwing Nazi salutes is still pretty troubling, especially when you consider Richard Spencer's and the alt-right's connections with the Trump campaign, when you consider the uptick in hate crimes in the United States. Swastikas have become almost commonplace, both online and being spray painted on buildings and people's homes. So it is alarming, and it can't be divorced from the current political situation. I mean, Richard Spencer is not at the White House. He's not Steve Bannon, but it is troubling that the alt-right and that the National Policy Institute sees itself empowered by the election results and sees it as an affirmation of their white supremacist worldview.
Nicole Hemmer, assistant professor at the University of Virginia and author of the new book, Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. Well, in a region ravaged by war with Islamic State militants, the Iraqi city of Sinjar remains devastated 1 year after being captured from the extremists. But worse than the destruction of the beloved center and loss of treasure for the Yazidis is what the United Nations calls a genocide against the religious minority. As VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Sinjar, Peshmerga forces continue to defend the city against IS militants just a few kilometers away.
Once a bustling city, Sinjar lies in ruins. There are no city services and hardly any people. Few families have returned since Peshmerga soldiers captured this city a year ago. Several different military groups allied against IS are stationed in the area. Locals say the initial IS takeover in 2014 was terrifying and swift.
When they first arrived, they were well armed because they had already taken Mosul and stolen weapons. So when they attacked, our forces had Kalashnikovs and IS had heavy artillery.
In the days and months that followed, tens of thousands of people fled the city. Some starved to death, others committed suicide to avoid the horrors IS was inflicting on the Yazidi people. Among the most terrifying acts was the kidnapping of thousands of women and girls.
I would rather they have killed me than witnessed what was done to my people. It was more than 3,000 girls and women, even Yazidi children. It is one thing to kill men, but to steal and rape women and girls?
Peshmerga forces captured Sinjar a year ago and still hold a line a few kilometers from IS positions. Heavy fighting only slowed a month ago, soldiers say, and the extremists still occupy about 20% of the region. For these soldiers, the stakes could not be higher.
IS took the people in groups, killed them, and put the bodies in dump trucks. Even old women, the bodies were thrown in holes along with some people who were buried alive.
Locals say they don't think this ruined city can be rebuilt, and they are sure, in this region of broken hearts, that their lives will be just as difficult to repair. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Sinjar, Iraq.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
A golden roasted turkey is the highlight of the traditional Thanksgiving feast in millions of Americans' homes on Thursday, but not at the Poplar Spring Animal Sanctuary in Poolesville, Maryland. VOA's Julie Tabo is here to tell us about it.
Every Thanksgiving, millions of Americans get together with family and friends to celebrate the season and give thanks for all the blessings in their lives. For many, a highlight of the holiday is eating traditional Thanksgiving foods like green beans and sweet potatoes and a big, fat turkey, which is usually carved and served with stuffing and lots of rich gravy. But here at Poplar Spring Animal Sanctuary in Poolesville, Maryland, the turkeys are not cooked and consumed, but cared for and celebrated. And for the past 18 years, visitors have been enjoying a special pre-Thanksgiving picnic where they get to eat with the turkeys. It's a popular community event organized by sanctuary co-founder Terry Cummings and her team.
You can see the difference between the wild turkey And the white girls who are so much heavier, they can't fly, they can't...
We love having this event because it's a great way for people to come out and celebrate a cruelty-free Thanksgiving, which so many people don't get a chance to do with their families.
It's also a chance to educate people about turkeys.
We wanted to show people that they all have personalities, that they're all wonderful. They are just like a cat or a dog. They're just like a companion animal. And we wanted to show that by having a vegan potluck, you can have delicious food without eating animals.
What do you have there?
Chickpea salad, pasta salad, bean salad. It's so good.
As visitors enjoy the meat and dairy-free picnic, some share the reasons why they were drawn to the event.
Well, we're here to support the sanctuary and enjoy great vegan food and sort of mingle with like-minded people.
This is a really good reminder of where the food that's on my plate is coming from and to be more mindful about what I'm eating.
I think having it at a sanctuary is just perfect because that's one of the biggest ideas behind being vegan is just compassion for all living creatures.
I really like that we get to be around the turkeys and see them living and how adorable they are.
The 174-hectare refuge is also home to about 200 other abused and abandoned farm animals.
My goodness, look at it!
Including goats, geese, and lots of pigs. The friendly porkers were a huge hit with visitors who enjoyed petting them and tossing them pumpkins as a special treat. Cummings hopes that after their experience at the sanctuary, visitors who aren't already vegan will be inspired to think about starting a new tradition of mindful, cruelty-free living. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Poolesville, Maryland.
And that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Pakistan's parliament recently voted unanimously to toughen the laws against so-called honor killings. The United States commends the efforts of Pakistan to end this barbaric practice. The newly passed legislation restricts the ability of family members to forgive those convicted of committing a so-called honor killing, a practice that had previously allowed many convicted killers to avoid prison. Forgiveness is now only allowed if someone convicted of a so-called honor killing is sentenced to death, in which case the sentence can be commuted to life in prison. Honor killings have long been a serious problem in Pakistan, and in recent years, public outrage against this practice has grown. According to a study, more than 1,000 women were killed last year in honor killings, often by male relatives who believed the victims had tarnished the family name by marrying a man of their own choosing, or even sitting or meeting with a man. There have been several particularly outrageous killings in recent months. Khadil Balouk, a social media celebrity and feminist, was choked to death by her brother. A mother, with the help of her son, strangled and set fire to her daughter because she married a man of her own choosing. A teenage girl was tied up in a car and set on fire on orders of tribal leaders, allegedly for helping a friend elope. The legislation strengthening punishments for so-called honor killing is an important step toward protecting women and girls in Pakistan, said U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby, and promoting their full participation in society. Raising social awareness and holding perpetrators accountable are critical next steps, and we will continue to support Pakistan's efforts. No woman anywhere should have to die for choosing whom she will marry or how to conduct her life.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.